Hey, before we get started here, if you are a repeat listener, can you do me a quick favor and rate and review the show right now? We're really making a push to get great guests on the show, and your reviews help us attract the very best guests. So if you could do that, I would really appreciate it. Now let's dive into the show.
What I've learned is most of the people who talk a lot shouldn't be listened to, and the people who should be heard are the ones who never speak. How do I find the person who doesn't speak? I'm just better off plowing a different path. And we made the next logical decision. We took a hard right turn, really, based on our understanding of the facts, and we seemingly were right.
Hey guys, David Robinson here. Welcome to the Lead Sponsor Podcast. Another great episode for you today. Today I've got Ryan Smith with me. Ryan Smith is the co-manager of multiple investment funds inside his company, Elevation Capital Group. And Ryan focuses on value add self-storage and mobile home park communities, and he has acquired over 2,000 units located in more than 25 states. Initial purchase price of those assets valuing over $700 million in real estate. So Ryan has been in the business for a very long time. He grew up in a real estate related family and had some experience in the single family residential space. Ultimately, he, after selling a business that he had started, it was actually a software that he built specifically for his father's company that he built at a very young age that ended up growing and getting to a place where he had over 110,000 users across the world using his application that he had built. He eventually sold that business and then got into real estate full time. He and his wife in their early 20s bought about 25 single family rental properties and built up their small portfolio and started running into some scalability challenges and ultimately moved into the commercial realm with an emphasis on self-storage and mobile home parks. He goes into exactly why he chose self-storage and mobile home parks, and why multifamily didn't make that list. He also talks about building a portfolio of over 20,000 units across 25 different states and his unique approach to management on these facilities. He goes into depth about how that's structured and how they're able to produce results that others aren't because of their unique management strategy. He also talks about what we're dealing with in the current economy today, how his company has taken a very conservative approach to their investing strategy, and how they plan to navigate the economy moving forward into 2023. So I really enjoyed my conversation with Ryan today. He's a wealth of knowledge with a tremendous amount of experience, and he goes into some detail into his business and his thoughts about the business that I think will be helpful to you. And so without further ado, Mr. Ryan Smith. All right, Ryan Smith, welcome to the show. Appreciate you coming on the Lead Sponsor Podcast with us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So if you don't mind, let's back up. Let's talk a little bit about this journey that you've been on. You've been at this for quite some time. I'd like to hear about how you got started in the space, maybe what you were doing before you got started in the real estate world. So let's back up a ways and let's test your memory here and talk a little bit about your background.
Sure. Yeah. Happy to go into it. I think I have probably more of a background than my years would indicate. I've been at it now over 20 years, which just... it's shocking that it's been that long. But in short, so I grew up in a real estate family, you know, very blue collar. There's a picture of me when I was in a crib on a roof that my dad was re-roofing. So, I'm, you know, that speaks to the way I was raised, the safety concerns or the lack thereof of my upbringing. But anyway, grew up in the real estate business from a sweat equity perspective, not a financial perspective, which is great. One without the other is fairly useless, I think. Kind of have to have both. But so I kind of transitioned. I was a coder. I'm fascinated by computers, taught myself to code, ended up learning how to code in 13 languages, would just love writing software. It's an odd hobby, but as a teenager, loved writing software. So I ended up building a software application for my dad's real estate business and our family business that allowed him to better financially analyze his investments, because we were doing it in Excel and Access databases, and that was all me. And I feared that, you know, when I grew up, I probably would not be able to leave my father's home, because all of that revolved around my capability for his benefit. So selfishly, I built him an application, and in all candor, it gave me a nice kind of business problem to solve with code. So I set out to do it, spent 3 months, one whole summer, coded every day. Anyway, built that application. It worked, surprised him, you know, I presented to him. In any way, a couple years later, I had about 110,000 users of my software globally as a teenager, that kind of mom and pops around the world and around the United States were using my software to analyze their investments, which was kind of an interesting on-ramp. Kind of at the same time, I was also an athlete, 6'8", you probably, you know, can't tell this in the little window, but kind of like you're athletically involved. I know you're into football, and that's, there's a lot you learn from sports. My sports were baseball and basketball, but I got drafted professionally by the Baltimore Orioles and the Anaheim Angels, played through college. So I had this duality where I kind of had the software thing going, the knowledge of real estate, the athletics, and ultimately decided that I was more sort of, I was probably more suited to brains than brawn. And so I hung up the cleats and really liked the business world and wanted to pursue that. So at that time, my wife and I really set a path forward to, you know, really invest our capital for our benefit and grow a portfolio. So we didn't start by, you know, saying, okay, where do we find a bunch of LPs or limited partners and raise money and all of that. It was, you know, we had thankfully some money from our software company and other work we were doing. And so we kind of early 20s, just to orient time-wise, or early 20s, we started buying single family residential. It's what our respective families had done. It's what we knew. Thankfully, I had a software tool I could use to analyze, and then cash from the software tool that it produced. And so we ended up building a portfolio of about 25 single family houses in our early 20s, which was pretty tremendous for us. We had both surpassed our parents by around 23, 24, and our parents are absolutely incredible. So that's not to diminish anything that they've done. But we found ourselves kind of in, you know, I would call it uncharted waters. We quickly realized that single family, you had to buy a lot to scale. We thought, you know, once you got 25, you'd start seeing economies of scale. It didn't happen. And so we started looking for a better path. And so to do this, it was the only thing that made sense to us, but we spent a long weekend and we basically built an underwriting for every asset class we could think of: apartments, billboards, storage, mobile home parks, apartments, industrial, the gamut. And the thought was, we'll throw them all on the table and let the models duke it out, and we'll go forward with the ones that make the most sense. And when I say most sense, it was four things we were looking for. And I say this because your listener may say, well, none of those four things is what I'm looking for. Well, then you may not want to consider these things. The four things we were looking for at the time: we wanted cash flow, we wanted income as one. We wanted capital appreciation. We wanted the value of our invested dollar to grow and bring friends. So that's two. We wanted tax benefits. And then fourth, we wanted cycle resiliency. Or there's 1,000 ways to say the same thing. We wanted a moated investment. We want non-correlation, low beta, all, you know, basically as the market does the roller coaster thing, we didn't want to be on the roller coaster as much as possible. So those were the four things we were looking for. And upon doing our analysis of all these asset classes, the two asset classes that stood out the most to us against those four things were self-storage and mobile home parks. We didn't go in with a dog in the fight. Quite honestly, I was shocked that mobile home parks came out as kind of a leader and storage a very close second. So anyway, that's the business we started building. We started buying mobile home parks and storage facilities and have purchased more than 100 since that point.
Love it. What a great synopsis. I want to dive into a few things here. First and foremost, going back to your coding days, I'm curious, what was the application? What did it do? Where is it at today?
Yeah, no. So I ended up selling it, and there's so many stories there, but it started with kind of a Visual Basic in DOS. Then it went to ANSI C, object-oriented C. I did COBOL, a little Fortran, a little assembly, then I really got into the C-sharp, Borland C, C-sharp, the .NET suite, Microsoft products, all the way to, I think when I stopped, I was writing SOAP APIs using XML interfaces for Exchange. But anyway, it was fun. So I did client side, I did server side, I did kind of exchanging data between client server. And I was going the route of building a, I was going the route of kind of going to the cloud. It was basically an online SaaS when I sold it. So,
And what did it do? What was its function? You mentioned that it helped you to analyze investments, but yeah, I'm just sort of curious, you know, who used it? What was the...
Good question. So it actually going off of memory now, because it's been so long, it did a number of things. So the principal feature was analysis. So it allowed you to financially analyze an investment looking forward, or you can start, you know, with the end goal and say, okay, well, I'd like my investment, you know, to reasonably produce this in the long run. And then you can actually put in inflation variables and all of these variables and then reverse calculate to what your purchase price needs to be, what's your threshold on financing, what's the down payment, and then you can risk model, you know, around all of those to really back into a better purchase decision, or say, okay, I think I have the optimal purchase, or the seller won't budge. These are the final variables. What will that produce? And then decide yay or nay, go or no go. So that was the first, and then you could track performance against those metrics. It had 25,000 legal documents built in that you could auto-generate on the fly. It had, you know, tenant trackers and anyway, for rent management collection. Love it. And it did a lot.
Do you know if it's still alive today?
I don't believe so.
Yeah.
I don't believe so. Yeah.
Cool. Well, that's a great backstory. And you mentioned that you grew up in a real estate family. You alluded to the fact that they were mainly involved in single family. Is that correct? Single family rental property? Okay.
Yep.
Right. So you built up and, you know, you played professional sports. You're in your early 20s. You start buying rental property, single family rental property, which is what you've known in the past. And then you start to bump your head against the challenge of scale. What caused you to say, was there anyone in your world at that time that said, hey, let's push into commercial? Because most people, many people, they run into the problem of scale and they just think, well, just continue buy more and, you know, build out a business around this single family rental portfolio, which it sounds like you were going that direction. But what was the catalyst for you to say, you know what, it's time to move into the commercial realm?
Yeah, no, good question. And I would say this is consistent with, I would say my wife and I and the way we move. It's not for all people. We're not all made the same. And this isn't necessarily the right answer. But for us, we had a business problem we were viewing in our business, which just, you know, in short, what I spoke to, their efficiencies weren't availing themselves. And so, you know, we had two paths forward. We could, you know, continue the same path expecting different results. We all know what that is. And eventually we would have found scale and that's fine. We just didn't know where that was. And so we did the process I described. We didn't really have a mentor or anybody pushing us and saying, hey, why don't you consider this? Because like I said, we were already beyond our parents at that point. Mm-hmm. Again, with all credit to them, we really didn't have anybody we were chasing or behind us pushing us. And it's also not our inclination necessarily to look for that and spend our time finding somebody who might know. And because what are the odds that somebody has, I mean, you know, in my world, you know, what I've learned is most of the people who talk a lot shouldn't be listened to. And the people who should be heard are the ones who never speak. So, you know, how do I find the person who doesn't speak? You know, I'm just better off plowing a different path. And we made the next logical decision. We took a hard right turn, really, based on our understanding of the facts. And we seemingly were right. And the best part about that is we now know why we made that decision. It's not because we know Tom or John or this other third party, and we're not contingent upon that person's advice. Not to say we don't have people who have mentored us. We have a host of people who I would say have mentored us. None of them know they have. Not one of them would call themselves our mentors. You know, we've learned from them.
So you hit that sort of breaking point and you decide, you know what, it's time to move into the commercial realm. We're going to analyze different asset types and asset classes and dive headlong in. you landed on self-storage and mobile home parks that hit your four criteria. I'm curious, because we do talk a lot about multifamily in on this podcast. What was it about self-storage and mobile home parks that caused you to go that direction versus multifamily, as they're, you know, have a lot of the same components?
For sure. And so I'll jump to the present, but it was also the same at that point in time. So what we were looking for, like those four things, at the end of the day, if you were to deduce those four things into a, you know, a KPI or a key performance indicator or a financial metric, it's really all around net operating income, you know, NOI. And so, you know, net operating income feeds into net cash flow. NOI feeds into valuation, you know, because basically you apply a cap rate to NOI to get value. So NOI is both cash flow and value oriented as one indicator. So, you know, I think everybody watching this, if we buy a property today and it has $100 of NOI, our hope is 10 years from now, it's more than 100, you know, the more the merrier. And so I wanted to buy a property or invest in an asset class that gave me the greatest chance based on historical performance of NOI growth. You know, what will the, you know, it's kind of a rising tide raises all boats. I wanted to be in an ocean with a rising tide and then arguably then, you know, bring my own skills and maybe outperform what that baseline was. But I wanted the baseline to be trending in the right direction. So that, to answer your question, when you look back, and this is sourced from NAREIT, you can go to NAREIT and get this data, it's public. But, you know, if you go back to base year 2000 to present, the three best performing asset classes for NOI growth over that period of time is, they got the most recent release of the data is self-storage, number one, very close. Number two is mobile home parks. And then I would say a more distant third is multifamily, which then is much ahead of office, industrial, and all the others. So if you were to say, hey, you can only invest in the top three, multifamily would be in it. And if you would say you can't invest in the top two, it would be multifamily for me. But the top two are storage, have historically been storage and mobile home park, purely for net operating income growth.
Love it. Hey, real quick, before we get back to the show, if you and I haven't connected yet, head on over to canovocapital.com and subscribe to my investor network. From there, my team will be in touch to schedule a brief call. I'd love to connect with you and learn more about your investing goals, what you're working on, what you're looking to do in the future, and also let you know about some of the projects we're working on over at Canovo Capital. So go down into the show notes right now and click on the link, or just head on over to canovocapital.com and subscribe to my network there. And I look forward to connecting with you. Let's get back to the show. And just for context, early 20s is when you built up a portfolio of 25 single family residential units. Then you moved into commercial. When did you buy your first commercial self-storage or mobile home park?
So we actually started with mobile home parks because we didn't want to be, you know, kind of jack of all trade, master of none. So we started with mobile home parks and later added storage. But our first commercial property, I want to say I bought when I was around 24. I think it was 24. My wife was probably around 22.
Okay, great. So you've had a long run at this. Let's talk about what, well, first and foremost, just for context, since you bought that first property, how much commercial real estate have you acquired since that first property? I believe in our show prep information, it was about $700 million. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that was original purchase price paid, not present value. But that or more.
Great. So acquired an original purchase price, $700 million plus. What does your business look like today? What are you focused on? How are things structured? Let's talk a little bit more about that.
Sure. So I'll start by saying we're obviously in a time when the market is changing. And so our business isn't changing because we try to take a tact that is one that no matter what the market throws at you, you're kind of offensively or proactively defensive. So we're not, you know, in the last 5 years, there's a lot of operators I saw, you know, and this isn't good or bad. It just is what it is. They were, you know, fully benefiting from the tailwind of what the market was giving them to the max. we showed restraint. And the way we showed restraint is, just in one example, is debt. One of the principal reasons you don't have a property in the long run is you took too much debt, or the wrong type of debt, or from the wrong lender. There's so many details there. And so we've really always tried to stay. So I'll bring this back to the question. So we're looking at solely storage and mobile home parks, very well located. The number one question we ask ourselves is the property moated? Is there a barrier to entry, a differentiating factor? Is the market quality? So these are markets like Washington, D.C., Alexandria, Virginia as a submarket, you know, Florida, Texas has them, Colorado, some in California. And then we use around 50% loan to cost at purchase, even when, you know, 3 years ago, you could get 75, 80%, maybe even 85% loan to cost. We were always at 50%. And so we try to keep a wide margin of safety. So well-located quality assets that we can add value to, moderate use of debt, focus on execution and management. And then the last thing is, you know, we have a very long time horizon. We're not trying to turn any kind of short flip to try to generate unbelievable IRR in the short run. We think we're much better off holding for the long run. So we're long-term owners, and our capital is long-term as well.
So I'm curious, you know, as with the mentality of longer term hold, generally holding onto these properties for an undetermined amount of time with the intent of potentially refinancing and repositioning the equity in those assets. The challenge is for a lot of private equity companies that are looking to grow is that those initial quick flips, quick hits, where they're able to buy an asset, really improve the NOI, and sell that asset off, gives them an influx of cash, which allows them to grow at a lot faster pace. Did you experience that early on? Was that a strategy early on? And did your strategy change over time? Or have you always been sort of this slow burn, let's buy assets, let's hang on to them, and we'll, you know, refinance when we can, use that equity? I'm just curious about sort of the long-term strategy that you deployed.
Well, we still own mobile home parks we bought 15 years ago. I still own several of those single family houses that I just spoke of. I'm actually looking over in the area right now of many of them. So no, we're long-term hold. It takes so much time, energy, effort, and risk to find the right set of properties. Then you take, you know, if you're doing cost-seg or cost segregation or any accelerated depreciation strategies, you're driving your tax basis down. You know, it really makes little to no sense to sell the property to the LP. Now, if the GP is trying to build the perception of, you know,
track record, performance, yeah,
trying to quickly build a track record, then it might make sense for them. But then you have fiduciary issues because that's their benefit over their benefit. You know, in short, for me, I think it's better to be long-term focused. It's better to the limited partner, the investors. I think it's better for most people to do that. Certainly there's, in some cases, it makes sense to sell an asset or assets short of holding, you know, if the risk profile changes, and, you know, I can see reasons to sell short, but I think a lot of folks are in a hurry to get someplace quicker. And in doing that, they create ripples and unintended consequences. And I think it's much better keep the long run. If you get there, you know, if it's worth dreaming about, getting there is great. If you get there sooner or later, you're still going to get there. But trying to get there too quick might jeopardize you getting there at all. So anyway, I'd just stay the course.
Yeah. So I believe at this point in time, you have acquired 20,000 units located in more than 25 different states. So pretty large geographic footprint. One of the challenges that I would assume you have to deal with is that geographic footprint and how to manage these different assets, especially in the mobile home park space. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you've navigated the management side of mobile home parks and then maybe self-storage as well?
Sure. So one of the, I guess this goes into our criteria of what we're looking for. So we're looking for major metros. So transportation to and from is much, much easier. We're looking for larger assets. So economies of scale relative to management and cost is more more doable. So on the mobile home park side, generally 150 units or more. You know, it's not unusual for us to buy 300 or more, which more than justifies the management footprint, even on a net new market, even if it's the first asset, only asset in the market. There are markets we're in, like Washington, D.C., which obviously is a broader market. The metro of Washington, D.C., we have more than 10 properties in that metro. So now everyone we buy, you know, there's a footprint there already, you know, kind of so on and so forth. Same goes for storage. And then lastly, the way we manage is a little bit different. And I'll just briefly mention it unless you want to go into, you know, further explore it. But, you know, what a lot of people will do, and you'll see this in a lot of structures, is you'll have, let's say you buy 100 properties, you'll have on-site managers, then you'll have this layer of district managers, then you might have regional managers, and then the regional managers, RMs, report to the COO, some kind of structure like that. We have found that that doesn't work that well and doesn't scale well. So our model is flatter. You know, first and foremost, we physically walk as a management team. We physically walk every property at least 2 times a year. So we're in the field constantly because, you know, obviously NOI has grown out there, not in here. So we need to be out there. And then second to that, we have what are called vice presidents of management. And so you think of it as a regional manager of sorts, but the way we do it is all of our vice presidents of management manage all properties. So we don't create territories or asset classes. All of our, you know, if somebody's experienced and has the wherewithal to be a VP of management, they have skills and abilities and maybe unique skills and abilities individual to them that all properties need to benefit from. So all of our VPs of management are responsible for all properties and they rotate on-site walks. So Jeff, one of our VPs, Jeff, he may physically walk a property every 5 months. And then Sandy every 5 months, starting with month two and month. So the properties are getting walked nearly monthly and then twice a year by us. And then they have on-site managers daily. So then when you set it against the size of the asset, the accessibility of the market, it works really well.
Interesting. So there's a lot of overlap and cross-management among your VP of management. They are not geographically focused. So they're traveling, just to give us some context. I mean, you're in 25 different states, right? So a VP of management would be required to travel to all of these different locations and walk the properties a couple times a year.
Yeah, they travel generally 48 weeks a year.
Got it. Interesting. So what kind of benefit are you seeing from that? Is it that there's overlap and there's a higher level of accountability because there's peers that are watching the performance of each asset?
Yes. So there's a couple. So one, cost savings. You don't have the bloat of middle management. Faster data and information to the top. You don't have the bloat in terms of information flow. You know, third, you have higher quality people touching the properties. You know, fourth, you reduce a lot of the risk in that, you know, and it does happen in some structures where you have one manager or managers really lean and become friendly with the RM, you know, and there's no cross-pollination, there's no objectivity. With our structure, you can try to win over Jeff, but Sandy's coming next month, you know, or vice versa. So the point being, it creates kind of more entrepreneurial, plus it's a lot more boots on the ground, higher quality people on the ground where the NOI has grown. And it's very rare that an on-site visit doesn't produce something additive to NOI, something we notice, something we see. You know, I can give you a lot of examples of that over the years, just things where, you know, it might take the fourth walk through a property and you look and say, hey, I think we can turn a locker. I have that extra space over there. I think we can actually add a locker there. You know, and you look at that and, you know, at the end of the day, every dollar of NOI is $240 in value. You know, so we're in the business of finding $240 dollars. And so that's what we're looking for.
Love it. So I want to shift gears a little bit and talk, maybe do it like a mini case study. You acquired an asset in Las Vegas in, last year. Maybe you can give us some context about what time frame or what time in the year that was, but bought it for $11.3 million. Maybe just take a minute, describe that asset and give us some context around how you sourced the deal and some of the structuring of the deal on the front end.
Yeah, so this is a property in Las Vegas, Nevada, storage facility. It was mom and pop owned, which we generally, really very specifically, we're almost solely buying mom and pop properties. This property was, as I recall, it was listed with a broker, but not widely distributed. It's pretty limited distribution. He called us. I think there were two properties in the package. We peeled the one that we wanted off, which was this one, and the seller broke them apart. So we were able to buy this property. It's not in Summerlin. If you're familiar with Las Vegas, on the west side is Summerlin, which if you ever make it on Jeopardy, was the first master plan community in the United States designed by Howard Hughes. Just unbelievable guy. But if any of us watching, if you've never been to Vegas, if you chose to move to Vegas, you'd probably want to live in Summerlin. And maybe second to Summerlin is Henderson. But Summerlin's a really nice pocket on the western edge of Las Vegas. This property is just outside of Summerlin, and it's on Tropicana Boulevard, which if you've ever been to Vegas, you probably know it connects with the Strip. So major thoroughfare, well-located, very dense and growing, densifying area. It out front of the property. So we acquired it for around $11.3 million. It has a lot of RV parking and covered parking, which we like because that's income generating in the short run, but it's physical space to, in the long run, build more storage, more mini storage, which is higher income producing per square foot than boat and RV storage. And so it's kind of, we get paid while we wait to get paid kind of thing. So there were some inefficiencies about the we went and saw the property, and even I'll skip to after we bought it. There was some, I remember before we bought it, we were walking it with the current manager at the time who did not stay on. There were panels that were dented by the back door. We were going in and there's a giant panel that was dented. And I'll say real quick, our brand standard is Disneyland clean. And that's a stated brand standard. So one thing you will notice at all of our properties, spotless. When you go into storage, there's always a cart right by the door. We don't make you go look for carts or pay for carts. Everything is around the customer experience, and it's spotless and clean. And so we go in the back door and the panel is dented, huge dent. And we asked the manager, we said, how long has that been there? He goes, oh, I don't know, 5-6 years. We're sitting here twitching already. So anyway, we knew at that point, if it didn't bother him, then there's probably not going to be a fit. So that was the beginning of some of the issues. That building had a swamp cooler, which is just blowing air over water. It's not ideal. So we properly climatized that building, replaced all the incandescent lights with LED lights, fixed all the dents, stings, painted. And then, I'd say more materially, out front on Tropicana, right across from an In-N-Out Burger, literally across the street, there's a car wash. It was called Tropicana Car Wash. It was like a 6-bay old, you get out of the car, wander, nothing automated. And so part of our thought was we could buy that facility. It's Main Street frontage right on Tropicana, tear down the car wash and build a 3-story, 30 to 40,000 square foot building to give an older facility the appearance of brand new, to approximately 50,000 cars a day. For visibility, plus the height of 3 stories. It was a single story at that point. So we bought it for 11 points. We have grown the income since purchasing it. It recently appraised for around $16 million. But that is exclusive of the new building that we are currently building. That building it's the third floor, just got poured, should open probably around February, March of next year. And I can walk through the economics of that, but we think that that facility will probably trade at some point in the future for closer to 30 once it's complete.
Wow, that's fantastic. So is that a typical strategy for you, is finding deals that have, we often talk about adding value, but you're looking for deals that have some of that unoptimized space, the RV, the covered parking, maybe new development opportunity. Is that what you're looking for in those deals? Are you ever buying a deal that simply is undermanaged but doesn't really have an opportunity to develop or add units?
No, good question. We'll buy properties without, I'd say, CapEx upside, where it's without a heavy spend to get value. But all the properties we buy, whether purely operational or and/or CapEx intensive, everything we buy, there's a value add component. But what we try to do is blend how heavy of a CapEx component, like the one I just described, is on the heavier end of CapEx, whereas there's other properties that we may buy with a lot less CapEx, more operational focus. But yet there's quite a bit of upside, we think, in the long run.
Yeah, love it. Well, we're running short on time. I've already kept you about as long as we had discussed, but if you're okay for a few more minutes, I've got a few final questions for you. I'd love to just get your thoughts on the economic environment that we're in and what a company like yours is doing to move forward and be productive, but also navigate these waters in a responsible way. We're just for context, we're recording the beginning of November here, 2022. So maybe just shed some light on your thoughts about what's going on in the market right now and how you're sort of leading your business through it.
Yeah, so I guess, you know, for those who are obviously aware of what's going on, we're facing rising rates, we're facing increasing volatility in a number of markets. You know, are we in a recession already? Are we going to be in a recession? How bad's the recession? You know, will the market fall from here, the stock market? You know, what are the ripples of that, you know, bond market? Anyway, it's just a lot of noise, you know, and I think a lot of people hoping we're not going to go where I think we all know we might. But in short, we have had the view prior to this year that this is going to be kind of a slog of a decade. It's going to be a long slog. And I've said as much for probably more than a year. So for us, nothing really is changing. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like I said, the levers we pull or don't pull, we think have been optimized for the long run in terms of debt. We're 50% loan to cost, you know, as compared with an operator who maybe 2-3 years ago, they made their numbers and their yield work by taking a ton of debt, you know, on assets that they acquired. They're at, you know, they may have risk in that, you know, if they have refinances coming due in the short run, they're not going to get anywhere close to 80%. So they may actually have to bring capital instead of getting money out. They may have to put money in to refinance. So the point is, we've been at 50% loan to cost. We'll remain at 50% loan to cost. There's loans today you could obtain at 50% loan to cost, so no change there. You know, our management is lean and mean, so there's really nothing, you know, new there. Moving into this, we've tried to build cash positions. You know, both. You know, I did a webinar, you know, earlier this year where with a really neat guy named Greg Brenneman, who's a hero of mine. But we were talking about the need for, on a personal basis, to have probably two years or more of cash. And we talked about that in February of this year before all of this, seeing where I thought things were going. I was trying to encourage us. You know, so we're trying to build, you know, we have cash personally, and then, you know, corporately trying to build our cash positions up as a large margin of safety for what could be. So, you know, we have good assets, well located, you know, fairly low debt utilization, a lot of long-term debt, laddered maturities, cash on hand, you know, so we, you know, there's not anything, any hard right turns we see that we're going to make. We still like mobile home parks and storage, and we think they'll do quite well, and they'll continue to shine as, you know, there'll be ups and downs and bumps along the way, but we think we're in a good position to manage through them.
Love it. Well, Ryan, I've enjoyed our conversation today. Really enjoyed hearing about your background and how you, you know, moved into the real estate space and some of the changes you made early on as you guys built up your small portfolio of personal rental properties and then decided to transition into the commercial side and what you've done to really set yourself apart in the self-storage and the mobile home park space. Before I let you go, what's the best way for our listeners to connect with you and learn more about what you have going on?
Happy to help if I can ever be helpful. So our website's elevationfund.com. My email is ryan@elevationcg.com. And then feel free, my phone number's on the site. Call anytime.
Love it. We'll have that information in the show notes. So if you've enjoyed the conversation that we've had with Ryan today, go down into the show notes right now, click on one of those links and connect with Ryan there. Again, Ryan, an honor to have you on the show. Thanks for coming on and sharing your journey with us. And I look forward to staying in touch with you down the road.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me.
Hey, before you go, if you and I haven't connected yet, please head on over to canovocapital.com. You can join our investor network or download our free passive investor's guide to multifamily syndications. Either way, I'd love to connect with you personally. Also, I just want to thank you for listening to the show and providing feedback and reviews. If you haven't already, please, please, please take a second and leave us a rating and written review. This helps us to be found by new listeners and helps us attract great guests in the future. Thanks again for listening to the show, and I hope you have a great day.